Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, he's controversial, he's written a new book, Richard Dawkins speaks to us about, you can guess what, evolution.
I think it might be a lost cause trying to people who really, really are totally convinced that the Bible is literally true.
Plus, someone else who knows a thing or two about natural selection, we take a trip down to the movies to learn about Darwin.
It's not a political tract that's like, you know, rah-rah Darwinism, you know, yup, who sucks creationism.
And a quick look at how to store carbon dioxide and hydrogen.
There is potential that we can use them to put them in the exhaust streams for industrial processes and actually take the carbon dioxide out of the exhaust stream before it actually gets into the atmosphere.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. It's kind of been a while since we've discussed faith and humanism and philosophy and stuff in this podcast, but here it is again. To help us safely negotiate this minefield from The Guardian's expert team, we have Nell Bowes. Hello, Nell.
Hello.
And James Randerson. Hello, James.
Hello.
Okay, our guest this week is Caspar Melville, who's the editor of New Humanist magazine. Caspar, welcome.
Hello.
Now, it says that New Humanist magazine is a journal for free thinkers dealing with humanism and atheism, but I'd like to think that you're more inclusive than that. Anyone can read, right?
Oh, anyone can read.
Yeah, anyone can
of
read.
Of course, yeah.
Especially those top trumps.
As long as they buy the magazine, right?
we've obviously had him in the pod before. Last November, you were here talking about the Atheist Christmas. And before that, and this that was also before the whole Atheist Bus campaign. But we're not here to talk about those things right now. We're here to talk about Dawkins and Darwin. But let's look at a couple of things in the current issue of New Humanist. One of the things that is one of the main essays in there is about how seriously we should take arguments against things like evolution and things. So a couple of films are going to come out soon. One of them is Expelled. Tell us about Expelled.
So Expelled is this documentary made by people who support intelligent design in the States. It was fronted by a guy called Ben Stein, who is apparently famous in America. I think he's most famous for having appeared in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Very, very good film. I don't know. He's an older kind of character. I guess he must have been
teacher?
A headmaster or a teacher, probably. Yeah. So he's a, you know, he's a famous daytime TV type figure who has decided to support ID, you know, intelligent design, which is a kind of shadow poor man's creationism. So they made a film which purported to uncover a conspiracy of silence around the way in which science in America wouldn't entertain any creationist ideas, wouldn't talk to creationism about creationism. They said it's a Darwinist conspiracy. And in this documentary, Ben Stein goes around the world, you know, talking to prominent atheists. I mean, the film's notorious because he managed to get interviews with Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and very many prominent Darwinists and got them saying very strong things against ID and in favor of evolution. He then intercuts these with pictures of Nazis at rallies and concentration camp guards and says, these people are so sure that they're right. They are squashing debate. They are basic. But the picture, that's what he says. The pictures say these people are a bunch of Nazis or communists. Funnily enough, it's exactly the same narrative being attached to Obama's attempt to reform the healthcare system. You know, if it's something bad in America, the right wing call you both a fascist and a communist at the same time and don't seem to think there's any contradiction.
There's no ideological difference between the two, it seems. And they're just words, aren't they? So Expelled is this film. I mean, I think people might have seen clips of this in bits and pieces over the last year. It's been in gestation for a while. It's already become controversial because it's highly selective in the way that it uses its interviews. And I think Richard Dawkins even has come back and said some of the interviews he did for that film, he was kind of duped into thinking it was a film about evolution.
I think they were stitched up massively.
Yeah. And so there are moments where Dawkins is, you know, pauses for thought and the commentary says something like, look, he can't even think of an answer for this, when in fact, if you read his books and if you talk to him, he's like, that was the moment he worked out what was going on and didn't want to say any more.
It's fairly cleverly done, I must say. I mean, you know, the way it's put together, the way they were clearly misled in order to appear in this, to give it some credence, they really go after some people. Eugenie Scott, who runs the Smithsonian, who's the big hate figure in America, the kind of the version of Dawkins. And then what they do is throw in all these other quote-unquote experts. What they don't say is every single one of them is in some way both strongly religious and associated with the Discovery Institute, which is the kind of, you know, quote unquote, again, think tank, which is trying to push the ID agenda in America. So It's full of distortions. It's got no science at all, actually. It's a kind of plea on behalf of American ideas of freedom to open the debate. But what's interesting, a bit like the BNP claiming that they've got, you know, minority rights, is the way that the right and the creationists have taken over this idea that they are the ones who want the proper and open debate. And it's people like Dawkins who just refuse to engage in an argument that says the Earth is 6,000 years old or whatever.
What is the best response? Do you just ignore this film, or do you go, right, here is a whole bunch of reasons why evolution is a good idea, and the kind of thing that biologists are doing all the time, isn't it? I mean, it would get tiring doing this again and again and
again.
Well,
that's the thing, isn't it? I think that on the one hand, it's a question which is always going to be there. It needs to be there, because if you do believe in open debate, I mean, one of the things, these people compare themselves to Galileo all the time, you know, which is very interesting, because they want to align themselves with the idea that anyone who's not part of the scientific orthodoxy first is treated as a madman, and then I think they close the film actually with, I don't know, that quote that says, you know, new ideas, the first they say that you're a madman, then they say they're obvious and everyone accepts them. It is important to have the lines of communication open, and the fact that this troubles us because we do want to have free and open debate is just built into the fact that we are committed to open debate, but there must be a cutoff point. There must be a certain moment when you say, well, I just can't, you know, I don't want to entertain this anymore. It's wasting my time. I mean, interestingly, Richard Dawkins has gone and written, you know, a book which in some degree seems to be a response to the Nutters. He's sort of saying, well, okay, I've been engaging with you in debate for, you know, months or years in America. So now I've written it all down. Hopefully, I think he'll then say that's the end of it for me.
I mean, Richard Dawkins has probably written that book many times. I mean, we'll talk about that in a sec. But the idea here, of course, is that by engaging with them, you're giving them more oxygen. James, do you think that's a bad idea? What would you think about this?
Well, I'm very torn. I mean, I've appeared on kind of radio talk shows in the US with creationists and tried to kind of argue against them. And it's, you know, it's rather like trying to deal with a sort of barrage from a Tommy gun, because, you know, you just get 100 facts to try and correct in less time than you have to correct them. And so it's very frustrating, and I'm kind of torn about whether it actually does any good. Maybe it does. But, I mean, the famous response from Dawkins was, you know, he was invited to debate openly with a creationist, and he said, well, you know, that will look rather better on your CV than it will on mine. And it's the characteristic Dawkinsian sort of style there. But I mean, you know, basically he's saying that, you know, if I appear with you, I'm going to give a certain credence to your line of thinking, which I don't want to do. And, you know, particularly when you're talking about young Earth creationism, I mean, that's just so ridiculous to kind of talk about on a scientific level that I think, you know, that is kind of pointless talking about. IDs is a little bit more subtle.
I was going to say there was something on the Cosmic Variants blog a couple of days ago that actually helped, I thought was a great way of breaking this down. It was Sean Carroll who came up with a grid of disputation, which has two axes. So the one is the agree-disagree. That's fine. That's where the debate's happening. And the other axis is crazy sensible. So you can actually break this down into who you want to, who are the crackpots, who are the people you disagree with and are crazy, and who are the worthy opponents who are sensible and yet still coming in, which is, it's kind of, it's quite nice to be able to actually group people in and see how far they off out of in those different quadrants.
Well, isn't that the thing? If you disagree with someone but you respect them for whatever other reason, then you will sit down and take the time to do that. But if you disrespect their methods, or you disrespect completely the way that they are doing something, then you're less likely to want to convince them. I mean, the thing with science surely is that you don't have to convince people. It's all about evidence or not.
But then, to some extent, are you demanding that you hold the debate on your own grounds methodologically? And that in itself is not necessarily kind of engaging in an open debate in the way. You don't have to go as far as allowing propaganda. You know, I mean, kind of propaganda on either side, clearly a bit dodgy. Images of Nazis probably loses you the argument quite quickly. There's a wonderful rule, which is the first person to introduce the Nazis as an analogy loses automatically.
Yeah, that's right. And that's an internet argument. I think that's called something.
Whose rule is it?
I can't remember.
It's genius.
It surely works on film as well. Yeah. This film straight in the garbage. Thank you. What I was intrigued with about this this sort of diagram is the quadrant embarrassing allies. These are the ones who you agree with but are a bit crazy. I was wondering if anyone had any ideas as to who would fit into that quadrant, or maybe we...
embarrassing allies. You deal with all sorts of people.
Well, we do, and you know, I have a big post bag. We call it the green ink file, which is a pile of letters from people who would be our allies in terms of our aims and ideas about religion and humanism, but are deeply embarrassing for lots of different reasons, including, the desire to sterilise lots of people, desire to prevent, foreigners coming to this country with their dodgy religious ideas, the person who wanted who wrote to us saying, I have today written to the Queen to ask her to arrest the Archbishop of Canterbury. we all have our fair share of that. I mean,
why don't you just get Richard Dawkins to email you rather than, wasting money on postage?
Tell you what, does the Queen have arresting powers? Does she have executive power?
I had one last thing, which I thought Sean's point, as well as the grid, was really interesting. Was simply, it comes down to what you're temperamentally suited to. So if you're temperamentally suited to taking the piss out of people, as possibly Mr. Dawkins might be, then that's what you'll do. And if you're temperamentally suited to calm discussion, then that's the way you're going to resolve it. And frankly,
I think that's true, but I think actually that there is another thing, which is, speaking as an editor of a magazine and sort of someone, is that debate is just one tactic, it's one genre. And actually, I do think debate is something where you're entitled to choose your debaters as someone that you actually want to talk to. And if it's people that you don't want to talk to, you think there's no chance they're going to change their mind, they're just idiots, they're weirdos or whatever, then, that's your choice. And you can address them in other kinds of ways. I mean, we've got creationism in the magazine in two different ways this time around. We're not engaging directly in debate with these people. One of them is our piece about Harun Yahya, the Muslim creationist. Now, this is a guy who's invited loads and loads of journalists to come and interview him. Adam Rutherford wrote about this on Comment is Free, actually, a while back. Should I go and interview him? He'll pay all expenses, fly out to Istanbul, put you up in a hotel if you want to come and talk to him. But all you're doing is giving him another example of how he's taking seriously in the West, and he puts it up on his website, and actually it's irrelevant what he said in the piece. So we decided to go a completely different route, and I got a journalist to really dig into who the hell he was, who was funding him, how could he afford to send the Atlas of Creation around. And what we find is a really, really great, in the sense of very salacious and grubby story about a man who is convinced he's the Messiah. So actually the best way to deal with him is not to directly bother with his arguments, which are pathetic, and actually I'm not sure he believes them himself, because they're just another in a long line of arguments that he's picked up in order to try and get some notoriety. Another thing we did was we sent someone down to the biblical zoo, Noah's Ark Zoo in near Bristol, who went for the day to find out what it was they were telling people. He took pictures, he looked at the signs, looked at the animals. Now, he did also ask the guy who owns the zoo, Anthony Bush, for his case. He didn't directly engage it. In fact, this came after he wrote the initial story, so we just put it on our blog, just a bunch of questions and answers. And in many ways, it kind of speaks for itself, I would say.
Let them give them the rope to hang.
Absolutely, and he certainly does hang himself out to dry, I would argue. I mean, he's peddling a more sophisticated version than the young Earth. He says it's ridiculous the Earth's not 6,000 years old, it's 100,000 years old. They're both wrong, and mine is the rational centre path, he says.
The average.
Yeah, 4.5 billion.
It's an odd type of average. But Casper, there's something slightly more complicated when you're dealing with things you disagree with. For example, there's another film that's out now called House of Numbers, which it'd be good to go through, because that one, again, that one questions whether there's a link between HIV and AIDS. Now, I would say I disagree with that thesis, that there's any question about those things. But you are more predisposed to be friendly towards this film.
Well, I'm not sure in the end. I mean, these are showing as part of the Cambridge Film Festival, so they're coming as a package. And the sort of master brand of these things, you might say, is denial films. So Expelled is very clearly an evolution denial film, although it doesn't bother to really talk about evolution. It just says we've been kept out of the debate. People who want to teach this have been sacked, and everyone's afraid because they really know that Darwinism isn't right, which is just nonsense. This film, which is made by a guy called Brent Leung, who's a kind of young filmmaker who steps up at the camera at the beginning and says, I don't really know anything about AIDS. I'm not a scientist. I'm going to go and find out. And he does have an extremely impressive array of people that he's spoken to, perhaps 30 major scientists, top people at the UN, top people, many of whom disagree with each other. And he opens out the disagreements that they have with each other. And he questions, using the voice of people who do seem very plausible, the direct link between HIV and AIDS. the way in which AIDS numbers are counted and who benefit from inflating ideas about who has AIDS, including one guy who actually said we all have AIDS. I'm not sure exactly what his argument was. He talks to people who have been diagnosed and then it turned out they hadn't had it because there was something wrong with the testing. And he makes some claims, which I think it left me. I mean, one of the claims, which is that the majority of people who died in the West from AIDS died because they were given extremely high doses of very toxic drugs. And the doses now are much less than those and the drugs are much more sophisticated. So I'm left with a whole bunch of questions. I would say that if it was a kind of a denial film, no, I think it's not a denial film. I think it's a questioning film. And I think it leaves the audience with a whole bunch of further questions that they want to go and find out. So I don't think it's trying to push you to one absolute conclusion, which I think is all in its favour. But I think it raises some very, very compelling issues about who is questioning science and the scientific orthodoxy. Are we allowed to question it? And you can see some scientists get very uncomfortable when they're being questioned very closely by this guy who arguably is doing us a sort of journalistic service. I'm not sure I'm going to go right out and make myself an expert on AIDS and HIV. On the other hand, it's led me to think that there is an open question, and I, you know, which I'd like more information on. I will read reporting on AIDS and on AIDS drugs and things with what I think is actually an increased understanding, even if it's not a conclusion, which I think might argue that the film has done a good job in that case.
All right. Well, Casper, thanks for all that. You can read all that by buying yourself a copy of the New Humanist magazine, of course, or you can take part in some of the debates at newhumanist.org.uk. Let's move the conversation on now to Richard Dawkins, the former professor of public understanding of science at Oxford and evolutionary biologist, has a new book out called The Greatest Show on Earth. Can you guess what it's about? He came into The Guardian to tell us what he thinks is the most compelling evidence for evolution by natural selection.
I suppose the clincher would be the comparative molecular genetics, looking at the distribution of genes throughout the animal kingdom and plant kingdom, because the information is so detailed and so voluminous. There's such an enormous amount of detailed textual information. You can literally compare animals and plants with each other, letter by letter, word by word, paragraph by paragraph, and actually count the number of similarities, the number of differences. And it all falls perfectly into a hierarchical tree, a family tree. The theory is not that difficult. I mean, it's not in the same league as quantum theory or relativity for difficulty of understanding. There are elements of difficulty. You can't really get it unless you appreciate the vastness of time that there's been for it to happen. Geological time is much greater, much longer than any human brain has ever been asked to contemplate. So we're used to decades and years and even centuries. Millennia kind of start to get a bit difficult to understand. But a million years, we just can't begin to grasp. As for 100 million years, which is what the sort of timescale you've got to get your head around if you really want to appreciate the history of life, then it's just way beyond our comprehension. It's not in principle difficult like quantum theory, but it's just harder. And I think that may be part of the problem.
I was wondering if there's also something about the fact that evolution explains all of the things we see around us, the great variety of plants and animals we see around us, which is kind of an obvious thing to people. They've seen the plants and the animals.
Well, they know they exist, but surely the fact that they're so complicated and so elegant cries out for an explanation.
Yes, and then evolution explains these things by adding further intermediates or animals which we no longer see from,
yes,
that we only see in the fossil record.
Yes.
And so in a sense it's taking something that people are comfortable with, are familiar with, and adding other bits on top
The logic of that doesn't work, does it? Because they have no right to be comfortable with it just because they could see them. I mean, it's one thing to see something, it's quite another thing to understand it. And you can contemplate a Boeing 747 and you can see it, you know it exists, but you're not satisfied until you're told how it came into being. In this case, engineers designed it and built it and so on. Well, in the case of a living thing, like a porcupine, you can see it, you know it's there, but you must have an explanation for why it exists. Now, many people are brought up with a spurious explanation just God did it. So you might just about be satisfied with that if you didn't think very hard. But it's not good enough just to say, well, I can see it, therefore it doesn't need an explanation.
Is one of the problems that the way in which evolution changes organisms is so as you say, it takes such a long time, and it is such a complicated process that
it's very
difficult.
Slow, yes.
And it's very difficult to actually nail down exactly the reasons for which transformations
I think
occur
that's from. Right, yes. I mean, I think it's, I mean, there are plenty of people who call themselves creationists who are quite happy with what they call microevolution. They can kind of cope with the idea of a peppered moth population changing from light coloured to dark coloured. What they can't grasp is that it's changes of that kind which, if you splice them together end to end over a very large number of millions of years, you get really big changes, like the change from a fish to an amphibian.
At some point, the evidence for the exact transformation you're telling isn't there. So you use a word like presumably.
Exactly. This
is that part of the problem?
Yes, I see what you mean. I mean, that could be a part of the problem because as I said, we know the general kind of form that any of these stories will take, and that's good hard science. But for any particular case, it may be that we have to resort to a plausibility argument. It could have been like this, it could have been like that. We don't know exactly how it was. Maybe we will one day when we get more fossils. But for the moment, it just has to be a plausibility story. I think it might be a lost cause trying to people who really, really are totally convinced that the Bible is literally true, which, by the way, wouldn't include any reputable vicar or bishop or cardinal or anybody like that. But I think that somebody who actually, I mean, there are people who've actually said, I don't care what the evidence shows, the Bible is true and that's that. And you can't really argue with people like that. I'm not sure I'd bother. Mm. It's just that there are enormous numbers of people who don't really think that, but who haven't really been exposed to the evidence.
Richard Dawkins there speaking to The Guardian's Richard Lee. There's a longer version of that interview, including his thoughts on climate change, in the latest Science Weekly Extra podcast. That should be on your iTunes feed now, or you can go to theguardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. You can also watch a video of Richard Dawkins talking about his book, The Greatest Show on Earth, on our website, guardian.co.uk/books. Following the British Science Festival in Guildford last week, we've extracted and stored up some of the most interesting interviews with some of the scientists there. Here's our latest snippet on how to store hydrogen and carbon dioxide.
My name's Ross Harrington and I work at Newcastle University. I'm looking at trying to make novel materials to store hydrogen safely. So at the moment we're looking at using hydrogen as a fuel, the fuel of the future. Moving towards a hydrogen economy. The only problem at the moment is finding a safe and effective way of storing the hydrogen. What we're trying to do is develop new materials that can store the hydrogen and let them be released as and when we want them for use in things like fuel cells, fuel cell vehicles, that sort of thing.
Does your research also have implications for carbon capture technology as well?
Well, in a way, the materials can be modified so that you can apply them to a number of different uses. So there is potential that we can use them to put them in the exhaust streams for industrial processes and actually take the carbon dioxide out of the exhaust streams before it actually gets into the atmosphere. So as a way of implementing carbon capture technology, then it's possibly a viable way forward.
So there's the potential then to produce hydrogen from, say, natural gas and capture the carbon dioxide that's released and use the hydrogen also in a very efficient manner.
Yeah, that would be an ideal scenario, I guess. Yeah, that would be very good.
How long till we see this technology on the market?
It depends. At the moment, it's a very much serendipity is the way forward. So it could be we do see a magic bullet that will make a massive leap and suddenly find the ideal material that will take things forward. I guess at the moment, we're a few years off, unfortunately. I'd like to say that we're right just around the corner, but we're a few years away, I think, at the moment.
Simon Chopin there asking the questions. Remember, join our Facebook group or post a comment on our wall if you want to have anything to say about this podcast, or you can follow us on our Twitter feed. Look for Science Weekly or Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Science Weekly's been to the movies this week. Creation is a new film about the life of Charles Darwin and how he wrote his seminal work on the origin of species. It examines his family life in particular and how the evidence he was accumulating in support of his theory affected his relationship with his wife, Emma. It was released this week in the UK, but the topic seems so controversial in the US that the film can't seem to find a distributor there. Producer Andy went along to the London Science Museum to meet the people behind the movie and find out what the moviegoers thought.
Well, I'm John Amiel and I directed Creation. I think they can expect the unexpected. I think if they're looking for a film entirely about Darwin's science, they're going to be very disappointed. We didn't want to make a movie about the science. We wanted to make a movie about the scientist. We didn't want to make a movie just about his ideas, but about the process by which he arrived at them. We didn't want to make a movie about the social and political context. We wanted to make a movie about his marriage and his family, out of which most of his ideas grew anyway.
So much of what scientists do is actually incredibly boring. Darwin spent 8 years dissecting barnacles. You know, put that in a movie. No car chases, you know, no action. How do you dramatize a life like that? And then how do you, in a sense, dramatize his ideas and the result of those, all that barnacle work? Were there any obstacles? What planet have you been living on? Of course there are obstacles. It's like pushing a giant ball of shit up a very steep hill. Who's the next scientist?
The sequel.
Einstein, I bet you. Because Einstein was a fun guy. He's a kind of wild and wacky guy and had a really interesting life, lots of sex. So probably make a great movie.
I'm the screenwriter for Creation. My name is John Culley. I think nowadays the debate between creationism and evolution is sort of over. Really, it's a false debate. The people who are talking about creationism are speaking about the way they were brought up and their emotional beliefs. To try and compare that with the people who are talking about evolution as a scientific discipline is to compare chalk with cheese. I think we can never, even if, however long we try to win that debate, that's an unwinnable debate, because these are two separate languages. The same applies absolutely to the infuriating debate about climate change. I think myself, many members of the public, and the vast majority of the science community find the debate about climate change, the ongoing debate, completely incomprehensible. It seems there's so much evidence for the disaster that's facing us. It baffles us in the scientific community and in the thinking general public that that is still regarded as something that doubt can be shed on. I think it's only when you understand that there are separate languages. There are the languages of emotion, the languages of mysticism, and the language of science, that you begin to understand not just what's gone wrong with communicating climate change, but also what scientists must do to communicate it better. We need to stop talking about the language of science, which can only take us so far, and we need to start talking much more, I think, in the language of emotion.
I'm Ariane Shireen, and I'm a journalist and comedy writer. It might not have been technically strictly accurate, but it was a great narrativization of Darwin's life. It was moving, compelling, and it made me realize how much harder it was in those days to lose your faith and to be an atheist or at least agnostic as opposed to falling in line with the rest of the community. And we're very lucky that scientists such as Darwin were brave enough in those days to tell the truth and to put forward ideas which were unconventional and which didn't fall in line with the ideas at the time, and to challenge preconceptions and everything that was assumed to be truth.
I really felt that the film has kind of been pushed more of a cerebral overview, and it's not. I mean, it's a love story, and it's I think it's been really misrepresented. It didn't necessarily tick the boxes that I thought it would coming here tonight.
Not very sciencey. I'm actually quite surprised that the audience actually stuck it out in there, because Nature magazine, a bit more scientific than I am, but they applauded at the end. It's going to be a good thing.
Well, I cry a lot, which is a good sign. I loved it. I think it was very, very nice, very sensible, very sensitive. I actually expected to be more nature-wise, like it would be more about his investigations and findings.
A very emotional ride, yes. Very moving.
It's beautiful. I don't know if you learned that much about Darwin, but it was a beautiful, intelligent script and wonderful piece of filmmaking.
So some moviegoers there talking about the new Darwin film, Creation. The last two comments I thought were quite interesting. The fact that it's not much about Darwin, but it's quite emotional. I think that's a fair summary of it, Casper.
I did cry when I saw it, I must say.
A point for it or against?
Well, I'll get to that. I mean, you know, I think that it, in genre-wise, it fits quite squarely into what I think of as kind of a default position really for big budget cinema and also daytime TV films, which is kind of parent porn, really. You know, imagine your child died and how bad you'd feel. And that's what happens. I mean, his favoured child, this incredibly sweet-looking girl from Italia Conti school or whatever, you know, dies and he's devastated and he's in denial until he then cries a lot, and then that unplugs him, and then he's able to finish his
and
book,
has lots
basically.
Of baths.
Has a lot of baths and gives her lots of baths, feels guilty, it breaks, you know, it destroys their relationship, but then they get it back together. So all of that is very
it's
moving.
Good drama.
Yeah.
Not so much about
in that
science.
Sense. It's nothing about science at all. Just nothing. I mean, in a way, it reminds me of a gag that Robin Ince does about, you know, to connote scientists, you have kind of lots and lots of tubes and things bubbling over with
books,
kind of but you know, that basically that's what you get. You don't get any. All right, there's some bits about him breeding pigeons, you know, and there's some pigeons there, and he's talking about how to skeletonize them and measuring the differences. And
it's a very, very well-made film. It's beautifully languid and beautifully shot. And if you want to know about a person with a family, it's a great film because he really loves his family, and he's devastated when his daughter dies, and he's separating. Well, he's having an emotional distance from his wife because of his work, but you don't really know what his work is in the film. If you didn't know what Darwin did, then this wouldn't tell you. Having said that, I wonder if when I saw it, I wondered at one thing, which was that people going to this film, if they wanted a mainstream audience, they would have thought, right, this is about Darwin. I should try and find out who this Darwin chap is. So I've heard all about him, evolution, etc. You go along and you think, well, the filmmakers might have thought to themselves, well, you know what, we want to make this Darwin not just a scientist, but a human being. So we're going to talk about his human aspect, his human side. And by that, we mean his relationships with all his family and all of that. There was a hint at the sort of brewing the natural selection would come up with, when at the beginning this very well sideburned character who is Thomas Huxley comes along and says, Darwin, he says you've kicked God in the face or something. What does he say? He says, you killed God.
I think, yeah.
And I thought, my goodness, is that what the film's going to be like? And it turns out that was the last bit of science in the whole thing. Now, things, it behoves me to say that I didn't like the film. I really did like the film. I think it was enjoyable, but it wasn't really about On the Origin of Species.
The other really worrying thing for me was that they decided to make it a ghost story, basically. I mean, it's full of this image of the dead child who is there. And the way that they're selling themselves is, you know, evolution wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for this ghost, basically. You know, it's a kind of modern day version
of
Ghost. I mean, it's ironic that Patrick Swayze, you know, just died. And, you know, it's a ghost film. And ghost films are very popular. So it's a bit like M. Night Shyamalan doing Shyamalan, is it? Doing, yes. You know, doing Origin of the Species.
I'd like to see him doing a movie of the On the Origin of Species.
I think it'd be a little bit more
exciting. Tell you, the
Beagle
ship would be pretty scary.
That would be quite interesting. Before we wind up this bit of the discussion, one of the things raised in that was that Darwin does question whether he should have married his cousin Emma, who he loves and has many children with, and he wonders if the fact that his daughter's died is because of that close breeding. I mean, there's an interesting piece in New Humanist this week. Do you want to just run us through it?
Yeah, this is a piece by anthropologist Adam Cooper, who's got a new book about the degree to which the 19th century bourgeoisie was intermarried in terms of marrying first cousins. And this is a brilliant bit of the story which they did not bring in. It's true that Darwin was very anxious about this, not only that Annie had died, but also that their baby had died, and had he passed on some sort of genetic weakness out of first cousin marriage, he was very worried about it. But what Cooper reveals is he was so worried about it, he did what a great scientist does. He designed a research project, and he got his son George to go out and look through all the scientific papers and do questionnaires. And it's a wonderful story that Adam Cooper tells, which includes some really brilliant detail. Like, did you know that Scotland in the 1860s had a deputy commissioner for lunacy? You know, and they had all these wonderful statements about, you know, 20% of idiots are from this, you know, from this kind of marriage or that kind of marriage. Anyway, the long and the short of it was that they did one of the first proper, rigorous kind of social scientific pieces of experimentation with statistics, and revealed actually that there wasn't evidence that marrying your first cousin was
deleterious,
that's a great word. And Cooper ties this in at the end of his piece with, you know, the contemporary anxiety about this in relation to Pakistani families marrying first cousins in the UK.
Well, you can actually hear some more proper film reviews in the Guardian's movie podcast. Go to guardian.co.uk/filmweekly. Please note, though, you're unlikely there to get any chat about the Large Hadron Collider.
Science Weekly.
Before we wind up the podcast, Casper, a quick question for you about this coming Christmas. Last year, You helped with Robin Ince organise the Nine Lessons and Carols for Godless People, which was a spectacular success. It pulled out all sorts of atheists and humanists from the woodwork that never knew they had others around them. Who's on the list this year?
Well, this year we're going big, we're going large. It's all dedicated in a way to the joke that Stuart Lead made about last year's, which was, if there's one thing I can't bear, it's the creeping commercialisation of atheist Christmas shows. So we're going big. We've got five nights at the Bloomsbury and a two-as-yet-to-be-announced bigger night, the 15th to the 19th of December. The bill is a vast array of fantastically talented people, Richard Herring and Josie Long and Gavin Osborne and Robin Hitchcock and Robin Ince, obviously. There's a hardcore of six acts who'll do every night. Simon Singh and Ben Goldacre, they're on there as well. And then there's lots and lots and lots of guests. Richard Dawkins is going to guest. We're hoping that Dara O'Brien will be able to do it. Richard Wiseman, Johnny Ball is lined up. Now, Johnny Ball might do his climate change denial song.
Is Johnny Ball still alive?
Of course he's still alive. He's kicking it. He's great. We've got Barry Cryer.
I'm a big fan of Johnny Ball. I just want to say that on the record right now.
Me too. I mean, he taught me everything I know about mathematics. So,
Casper, are you really going to get Richard Dawkins on that, or are you just going to be you doing an impression of Richard Dawkins?
Well, no.
Come on.
If I do any more of that, he definitely won't come, will he? He's booked in for the Saturday night. Go on to the Bloomsbury website, thebloomsbury.com.
Or, of course, there'll be trails and things at newhumanist.org.uk as well. I'm assuming we're going to be blogging, I'm sure, at guardian.co.uk/science/blog. Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks very much to Casper Melville from New Humanist magazine and to Nell Bowes and James Randerson. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Next week, Chris French will be our studio guest. He's co-editor of The Skeptic, who will no doubt be discussing anomalistic psychology. There'll also be some other stuff we'll probably cobble together at the last minute. Most importantly, though, I'm going to be holidaying next week on my own private island, so we're going to have a new substitute presenter. Find out who that exciting person is next week.